Interview with Robert Armstrong, ARMSTRONG, Land Commissioner for the State of Texas, Austin, Texas, December 10th, 1974. And basically, explain to us a little bit just what is the Land Commissioner's role and job, and what is the office and the function? It seems, is that a peculiar position to Texas, or a Texas position that's peculiar to Texas?
There is there is no total parallel. When Texas came into the Union, they offered their public lands to the United States in exchange for the assumption by the United States of a debt of some $10 million. The federal government said, look, we weren't born yesterday. We just bought Louisiana for $15 million. There's no way the lands of Texas could be worth $10 million. So you keep your lands and you keep your debt, and we'll accept you. And so we made that trade and entered the Union on that basis. The most parallel office that you would probably be aware of would be Secretary of Interior. We lease all of the public lands for oil and gas. We manage the coastal lands in conjunction with Parks and Wildlife for recreation and that sort of thing. But our primary function is as a proprietor and a lessor of the public lands.
And part of this is set aside for public schools and part for higher education.
Is it separate? There are certain lands that are dedicated to the universities, which the universities manage. But by tradition, the Land Commissioner has served as chairman of the university's board for lease in terms of minerals. We have no jurisdiction over what they do in their surface leasing. The total area that the office has jurisdiction over is 22.5 million acres, which is an area just larger than Maine and just smaller than Illinois. 22.5 million acres is just a number to most people, and was to me until I tried to equate it with some other land mass. But it's pretty well scattered. Most of it is the coastal area, submerged lands out to 3 marine leagues. And then we have a very sophisticated and unique traditional method of classifying some lands as mineral classified, which means that somebody owns the surface, but the state owns the minerals, and then we're partners with the surface owner on the leasing of those minerals. There's quite a bit of that. When we found that there might be oil, then we started selling the surface to people, but keeping the minerals for the state. There's quite a bit of that area.
Is that included in the 22 million? Or
yes.
Is that...
It's mineral acres. But it's... I guess, with the exception of Interior, we have more leasing jurisdiction than in any other office in the United States.
How much acreage is owned by the university system?
2,200,000. They received that part by grant, and part of the land that they had a bunch of granite under it. And they built the capital out of that granite and exchanged land in far west Texas for the granite. But as it turned out, it was very dry, barren country, but it also was right on top of the Permian Basin, which is the most productive oil and gas area on the continent.
And the revenue from that land goes into a permanent fund. Am I correct that the corpus is not used?
We invest the money and live off the income. This has been a battle I have fought and had to fight, because the legislature is constantly saying, why couldn't we just spend the revenue like Louisiana? The answer is that Louisiana is now down to $77 million a year in income, and going down. And if not going down, it's because of prices, but their production is going down. Ironically, the revenue from the school fund after its investment to the state is $77 million. But that is going to be there in perpetuity. And as the fund increases, will probably increase. But we feel that it's a much wiser policy to invest when the source of your income is depletable, because we'll run out of oil and gas someday.
But your income, The income from this land is based on leases.
That's right.
Rather than the actual oil itself.
That's right. I mean, well, on oil and gas leasing in traditional
right.
sense. But we receive bonuses, and then we receive royalties when production is affected. And our royalty income right now is $100 million a year. It is up 64% from 73 to 74 because of oil prices principally, but also because of some of the things we've been doing to
More income. The lease system provides royalties that are based on the income produced then. Is that basically right?
The oil that's produced. I mean, the basic lease is for a bonus which is paid per acre and a one-fifth royalty. So one-fifth of the production results in revenue to the state. We moved a royalty from a sixth to a fifth this last year, which was not welcomed by the oil industry.
Did that require legislation?
No. I just made the decision and sold my board on it.
And your board has that authority?
Yes. And we also do some royalty bidding, where we fix the bonus at, say, $40 an acre and say, okay, the guy that'll pay us the most royalty gets the lease. That's resulted in 143% royalty bid, 170% royalty bid in the Bay Area, and one royalty bid of 95% on a very small tract in a river where they just wanted the oil to refine, and they'd make their money there. But they were highly competitive as a result of that. So we've tried to be innovative about the way we do it.
Does all of this revenue go into the special school fund?
Mm-hmm. The Constitution provides that revenues from the sale of the land or any income derived from the land goes to education. It is placed in a permanent school fund, which now has almost $1.1 billion in it. It'll top that this probably before the end of the year. It topped $1 billion about a year ago.
How is the money distributed?
It's available for the legislature to appropriate. See, half of our...
Is it done on a per-pupil basis?
No. There's no allocation. Now, there's an allocation formula of state money that is on a per-pupil basis right now, and we're talking about whether that's needing to be changed at the legislature. But all we do is help with the tax load. And though that's a lot of money, the help, because the load is so great, half of every tax dollar goes to education in this state. And so we pick up about 1.5% of it from the income from the fund. So
I see.
So a taxpayer gets an education dollar for 98.5 cents. The balance is made up by the education
fund.
See.
So this goes into, the general education fund.
That's right.
Draws on this.
Right. And the legislature just appropriates it. It's just that much money they don't have to appropriate out of taxes.
And how much does the university fund amount to now?
Pretty close to $700 million. So though they have less acres, their acres are on top of oil and gas, is the reason they have such a disproportionate amount.
Is your office responsible for the investment?
No. All we do is get it to the treasurer, and the treasurer puts it into the fund, and the fund is then invested by committee of the Board of Education. Same with the university. They have an investment officer. They have it programmed. They know how much they're going to get. They have everything ordered so that there's no lag time between the time we get the money and the time we get it in to whatever.
Are there restrictions on how it can be invested?
Yes. They, for a long time, could only invest in government bonds and stocks, treasury notes. We changed that to a 50% restriction such that they could, under the prudent man rule, invest in corporate stocks. And then they changed it further so that up to 100%, I suppose, could be invested in the market as opposed to governments. But it's worked out that they still stay pretty well about 50%, but they also have restrictions. They can't invest more than 1% of the fund in any single issue. They cannot own more than a percentage point or some percentage of any one company. It's fairly well restricted using kind of traditional legislative restrictions to keep the hanky-panky out of it.
And you've been in this office how long?
4 years.
And were you in political office before that?
I was a House member for 7 years before that.
From where?
This district, Austin.
Are you a lawyer?
Yes.
And what other changes have you made besides going from the 1/6 to 1/5?
Oh, we've made some rather significant changes in placing environmental restrictions on drilling, such that we do it within an environmental context. Every tract that we lease is submitted first to the Parks and Wildlife people, then to the Bureau of Sports Fisheries. We also submit it if it's in a restricted area, such as proximity to the Aransas National Wildlife Area, Padre Island Seashore, any body who has an environmental interest in the way the tract is developed is asked to comment and suggest restrictions prior to the time that we put the tract up for lease. The companies were very suspect of this practice when I instituted it, but I campaigned on that issue. And as a result of this, we have leased all the time that Louisiana has been stopped, that federal offshore has been stopped by various suits by the Sierra Club and that kind of thing, because we do it at the beginning and we do our production within a sound environmental context so that you protect your renewable resource capability at the same time that you're producing your finite resources.
Does the oil and gas that's produced or drilled, what would be the proper term?
Either.
That's produced on the state-owned land, is it also subject to other state taxes?
There is a severance tax, so-called wellhead tax,
right,
a production tax, and so it is taxed as well as the royalty being paid.
And what is that? What is the basis of that tax? I mean, what percentage?
I would have to defer to the controller on that. I don't know. I know that a sizable proportion of our...
But am I correct, the wellhead tax is a percentage of the price?
Yes. So that a sizable proportion of the amount of money we have right now, and we, you know, are operating with a very strong surplus, it's attributable to inflation, which causes the sales tax to rise, and also to the production taxes, and also the fact that we're getting royalty now on gas that this time last year was moving from 20 to 50 cents, and that is now at $1.85. So you can see.
So the wellhead
that all
return
of this
to the state has increased proportionately.
Mm-hmm.
And how much does the state have in surplus? There is about $500 million, is that?
No, I think it's $1.5 billion.
At the end of this year, is that?
That's correct.
And that would
maybe
sort of
more.
It just basically unanticipated, is that right?
No one could see the effect at the time that we were talking about increasing the sales tax, that it would produce what it did. No one anticipated the gas prices and the oil prices going up.
You don't know what percentage of the state revenue comes from gas and oil tax, the wellhead tax?
No, I don't. That's somebody else's area.
Are you familiar with what Louisiana did about a year ago?
In what regard?
They had that special session and changed the formula on taxing gas and oil.
No, I don't think so. Was it to get away from the intrastate problem?
To increase the state revenue, I think they put it on a percentage basis, more similar to what Texas did, and simultaneously eliminated sales tax on food.
We've never had a sales tax on
food.
I fought that one in the legislature, and we killed it.
How long have you been in politics?
Oh, I quit work in 1960 in a law office and went to work for Kennedy and Johnson. And that was my first professional effort where I got paid for it. I'd worked in Dollars for Democrats and that kind of thing before then, in 58. But then I ran for the House in 63. So I've held office for 11 years, and seven in the House and four here. And then I was just reelected for a four-year term.
Is this office seen as a stepping stone or a jumping off?
Depends on who's in it and depends on who's looking at it.
Who's been in it? I mean,
well,
it's sort of a career.
It has been very, very spotty. One of my predecessors went to the penitentiary. You can imagine the
you'd hardly call that
discretion.
Upward mobility.
I mean, it's a stepping stone. It's just where you step to. You may slip off the rock. No, it's but the and oddly enough, the guy who went to the penitentiary was a very odds-on choice for governor. Had everything going his way. Among other things, was rich. But we have a veterans loan program, which lends, it's about a $400 million program in terms of total authority. And we make loans to veterans at a very long-term, low interest rate. And they then can buy rural land. It has to be 10 acres or more. And it's a super kind of thing because it doesn't cost the taxpayer anything, like a bonus or educational benefits. We just pledge the state's credit, which gives us the so-called tax-free municipal treatment capability. We can sell those bonds for 4.5% because they are tax-free. Then we pass along that advantage to the veteran and lend to him at 5.5%. So this means that he gets that money, which, as opposed to the present market, is about a $3,000 advantage if the land doesn't go up. But we've had some fantastic examples of people who bought 75 or 80 acres 15 years ago that they still pay us on their $7,500 to $10,000 loan, and yet they've sold off half of that tract for upwards of $250,000. But it's been a very successful program. It's very popular, and we had a constitutional amendment to extend it last year, which I worked on pretty heavily as a public matter to get people to vote for it, and they voted down half the amendments, but this one led the ticket because it doesn't cost the taxpayer anything, and it is successful. But my predecessor got to messing with it initially and made a couple of hundred loans to people who didn't exist, and then it got back one way or another to some other people. And
are you the first commissioner to really take on the oil and gas industry on anything?
Well, I don't look at it that I take them on. I look at it that...
Where you had a basic disagreement.
That I... You know, they said they could never do business at anything other than a six, that the feds only were doing business at a six, and if they could handle a six, that we could. And I frankly had some misgivings about what would happen. I thought maybe, you know, they'd go to Louisiana or they'd go elsewhere. But I also had some faith that if prices were going from $3 to $10 or from 20 cents to a dollar for gas, that they could stand a 3%, which is what it amounted to, increase from a 6. Of course, their analysis was that this was whatever 3% bore to 16%, and it was really a 30% increase or 25, something like that. But the upshot of it was that at the next lease sale, we had the biggest sale we've ever had in terms of bonuses. We took in $54 million in one morning, so it didn't scare them off too much. But the office moved from an eighth to a sixth in the 50s, but it was almost a consensus sort of thing. Alan Shivers was governor, and he put it on. The board that I work with has one appointee by the governor and one appointee by the attorney general. But traditionally, the governors and attorney generals have been the moving forces, and then the commissioners taking credit for what they did. The governor and lieutenant and attorney general, since I've been here, have been pretty much guided by my judgment and say, you know, do whatever you want to. That's particularly true of the Attorney General. I never could get the governor on the phone for a period of about a month and a half, so I went from a 6th to a 5th anyhow. He never could call me back. But that's a personality problem. I mean, it's peculiar to this governor.
Where do you see yourself going politically?
I don't know. I'm tired right now. 4 years is kind of an awesome length of time to tie yourself to. I frankly enjoy the 2-year terms, because if you did a good job, they left you alone, and if you didn't, you probably ought to have trouble.
Has this been changed
but
to a 4-year term?
We just changed. We've been 2 years. Everything's 4 years now. It was 2 up until now. I don't have any real up-the-ladder ego problems. We've seen this historically. It produces bad government, in my judgment. I think you do a disservice if you're looking over your shoulder all the time about decisions relating to what it's going to get you. We lost Barnes. I don't know if you know, historically, we had a guy that was almost president of the United States before he was, through being speaker. Lyndon Johnson mentioned this, and that kind of thing. And it's, your friends have a lot more ideas about where they'd like to have you, without regard to what it might do to your family or yourself or anything else. The thing I like about this job is the job. And obviously, I've been involved in politics, which is fun, but I have people who are encouraging me to run against John Tower. I have people who are encouraging me to run for governor. I have people who are encouraging me to stay right here because this is a very significant office. Given the constitutional restrictions, I'm not sure that I can't do more when I wake up in the morning than the governor can. So it will depend on who the available people are, whether I can tolerate them or not. If I think we're going to have a good governor and a good United States senator, I'm not going to feel compelled to do whatever it would do to your family. And I feel like this is a blessing. I've seen it grab hold of guys where they just had to be, whatever it is. And, I'm glad I don't get that way. But right now we've got 4 years of things to do. And I'm going to run for governor, or I'm going to run for the United States Senate, or I'm going to run for land commissioner, or I'm not going to run for anything. These are all very viable options in my life right now. And hopefully I'll have some control over them.
Do you agree with the assertion that the next governor is going to come from 3 or 4 of you who are basically moderating your approach or progressive? The next governor of
it
Texas
depends on how the timing works out. I think it is highly unlikely that any of the, I don't know who the 4 are, I presume you're talking about Hill, Hobby, me, and who? Bullock?
Commissioner of Agriculture.
John White?
Yeah.
I doubt very seriously if any of the 4, based on their prior track records, are going to make any glaring mistakes, make anybody very mad. I think, I was here when I was the only one that wasn't either a Smith or a Barnes or a Sharpstown tainted person. Broder was in out of Washington. He said, well, what do you do when you're in this situation? Everybody that's in office gives you a bad name, and I think what you do is, I told him, you go to work every morning and you hope something nice happens. And sure enough, something at least nicer did happen. We turned all those people who were tainted out in one fell swoop with varying degrees of success. Hill is an exemplary office holder as far as I'm concerned by objective standards. Doff has been very disappointing to me. And I hope he does better. But he's had a staff problem, he's had health problems, family problems, and it's just been very difficult to do any business with the office.
But do you see a younger, more progressive kind of a man emerging?
Oh, yeah.
The Latoya Rice?
Well, those are all the alternatives. You know,
would you characterize Driscoll's administration as sort of a caretaker?
Oh, yeah, and you know, it's what people wanted. At least it's been clean. But it hadn't done anything in terms of leadership.
How old are you now?
I'm 42 since this time last month. 42 in November. And it's difficult for me to recognize that with the exception of White and James, that I've been in office longer than anybody else in state government, you know, at the statewide elected level. And that's how dramatic the change was. And I think what you're going to see is you'll have a governor change. You'll have a lieutenant governor change because Hobby will run for governor, I think, or something else, but probably governor. I think Attorney General will run for governor. I think Bullock is going to run for something else.
Who is Bullock?
Bullock is the newly elected controller, kind of a maverick. Used to be very business-oriented, conservative now, saying he has religion, has a great deal of liberal support, but very uneasy liberal support, but still support. I think that White is talking about moving. James will either retire or be defeated. I'm either going to move on or out. And so I think what you may well see at the end of this next year is that every single one of the offices is going to be with somebody new in it. Now, it may be one of the existing office holders, but I think that at the end of next year, everyone will have moved and or quit.
If three or four types like you get involved in it, won't you end up in the same situation that elected Driscoll in the first place? That somebody with more conservative would come in?
Well, I don't know. Who would that be? I mean, you know, that's what, you know, the finance laws are such that a guy like Briscoe's not going to be able to do it out of his own pocket. If you look at who won last time, they all had one brace of common traits. They were out of office, they were clean, and they were rich. And they could finance their own campaign, at least in part or major part, out of their own pocket. Briscoe spent $600,000. Hobby spent over $1.2 million. No telling how much of it was his. Hill, you know, there's not a person in the upper echelons that has a net worth under $2 million until you get down to my office. Just astounding. But I mean, that's who won.
You don't think that could be repeated?
No, because I think your campaign laws are going to change, certainly for your United States Senate race, and I don't know what they're going to do, but. But the other thing is, the money situation's like it is. You're not going to be able to buy name identification, and you're not going to be able to buy. I think the effect of the campaign laws is to place a great deal of power in the hands of present incumbents.
Is there state campaign laws also in that area?
There are going to be some proposed.
Are they likely to pass?
50-50. In that level. Now, there are going to be some pretty stringent campaign reporting laws and that sort of thing. But
that would be a fundamental change in Texas politics if those laws are passed.
Oh, yeah. Common Cause is working pretty hard. You know, excuse me.
Yes?
Yeah, I'll talk to you.
In the time that you've been in politics in Texas, what are the major changes you've seen?
I think you've seen a move, not necessarily to a liberal viewpoint, but a move to a much more progressive viewpoint because of the thrust of the liberals. You know, they've called some things to the attention of the public that needed doing. And I'm a great believer that the two factors in politics that you don't hear much about are timing and just gut fortune. You know, it all races are run at a certain time between basically two individuals. And we have had, for whatever reasons, the kind of political climate at times of races such that people have moved forward. But we also still have a very personality-oriented, as opposed to philosophical-oriented, kind of environment. For example, Lloyd Benson, conservative, beats Ralph Yarborough, liberal, at the time that I, who was considered to be a moderate to liberal, beat a very conservative incumbent. So, you know, what do you make out of that? I think what you make out of it was that Benson and I were more acceptable to the people than Ralph Yarborough and Jerry Sadler at that time. So it's hard to get a handle on. But I think that, you know, during the time that I was in the legislature and the time that I've been here, I have done some things which were very historically unacceptable. And, you know, the money people or the oil people or somebody else would have gotten me and had the capability. Well, they don't have that capability anymore. Part of this is because there are more people in the state. Part of this is because of the reporting system in politics. They couldn't fog in $1 million to try to beat you because you didn't do something they liked. It would be too apparent. So you have that kind of thing happening, and it's really a great freedom. I always felt like in Travis County it was a good county to run in because you could do whatever you wanted to if it was right and get reelected. And consequently, I mean, you had to be able to make your case and explain your case. Now, there are some districts in the state that no matter how right you are, you can't be reelected if you do something that needs to be done if it doesn't suit the philosophy of that district. Travis County is not that way. They're very aware of the legislature and that kind of thing. So while I did some relatively progressive things, particularly environmental legislation and that sort of thing, early on, I ran without an opponent the whole time I was in the House. Although my voting record was probably, with AFL-CIO, it was about 50-50. But there were a lot of times, by comparison, the other people who were serving in the district had a voting record of anywhere from 70 to 80% against AFL-CIO. But people were tolerant of me because I explained why I was doing this. Now, Travis County has subsequently become very liberal, principally because of student voting organizations and that sort of thing. But it's a pretty progressive county in terms of who it elects and the kinds of people. And, you know, we elected a black and a Chicano with countywide voting this last time. And that's relatively unusual for Texas. Most of the blacks and Chicanos come from single-member districts. I was involved in a lot of controversy in the redistricting bill. I'm on what is known as a redistricting board, such that if legislature fails to redistrict itself, five of us then do the job. And I went through that fight and was strong for single-member districts. Well, that's not what you would think would be a philosophical statewide kind of thing, and yet people are tolerant of that. I hope because I made the case. Right after that tremendous fuss, I led the ticket in the primary. This time, I did extremely well, within a half a percentage point of leading the ticket, I think, or a quarter, and I spent $7,000 on a statewide race. But I've just had the philosophy that if you're doing right and people understand what you're doing, they're fine. I was McGovern's co-chairman, White and I. And, you know, I spent 3 months of interviews of how terrible it was that I had such a great political career that I had just dashed on the rocks by supporting McGovern. McGovern gets the same percentage he gets all over everywhere. He gets, 26%, and I get 97.8%. So, you know, I don't know what makes it go. I'm still confused about it. You just can't make rules in Texas. It's changing. But I think you have to realize that it's basically a personality-oriented thing as opposed to a philosophical thing.
What's your relations with the press? Because apparently you
you're able to communicate what you're doing to the public?
Well, Barefoot Sanders, who was running against Yarbrough, came in here one day and said, you know, George Christian says that you have the best relationship with the press of any politician he has ever seen. And I want to have that same relationship, and I want to know how you did it so that when I run this race against Yarbrough, I'll be able to do what you do. And I said, well, Barefoot, you know, you start by having the good fortune, again, of having your seat located in the House for 7 long years next to the press table, such that they know you and you know them, and they've watched you and they trust you, and you know when you're on the record, and I have never been off the record with the press, so-called, in saying this, but I've also said, here's something you really ought not to write right now, because if you do it right now, it's going to blow something, you know, and there's certain rules about that that they appreciate, but most of them, are my friends, and they know that I'm going to shoot straight with them, and we just get along. But it's been over a period of years that it's happened.
How about when you do substantive things in this office? Do you call a press conference? Do you?
And they call and check on me every once in a while.
Say when you went from a 6th to a 5th, well, how did you handle that in terms of press?
Oh, we put out the notice that we were going to consider it. We did it with a hearing. I'm telling you, they all came to the party. We had every oil executive, there were planes in here out of California, New York, but principally Houston. And they testified. We listened to them, asked them questions. Then we made the decision. And so we put out press releases when we discover the dramatic increases in revenue, which we did, we really didn't realize how dramatic it was. We put one out. I noticed, I was over there a while ago, Pat Martinet showed me a front page story on our opposition to federal offshore without some sort of compensation to the state. They tell us, well, offshore development is good for you. You'll have all these new people coming in. You'll have all these new jobs opening up. We figure that we get $49 million in direct revenue benefits from federal Outer Continental Shelf development. It costs us $111 million in services, education, police protection, highways, docks, helioports, that sort of thing, to make that $49 million. We lose $62 million a year as a result of Outer Continental Shelf development. I call that to their attention. They're interested in it, But I try, I don't jack them around and I don't trespass on them. I don't go over there a lot. I try to go over there when it is significant. And it's worked out.
What's the role and effect of the Texas Observer in Texas politics?
I think it's one of those propelling kinds of things that knock the edge off of the conservative side. I think their investigative reporting is such that though they have a relatively low circulation, somebody that was inclined to do something wrong might not do it because they were afraid of the Observer. I think they've been a real force philosophically and in terms of investigative reporting. Which is not to say that some of the reporters on the Dallas News haven't been. Dave McNeely, Sam Kinch, Fred Montevito with the Post.
Has general level of reporting picked up in the last decade or so in Texas?
I think it's changed its philosophical background. I don't think that the editors and the publishers have as much to say. The editorial board of the Dallas News, I doubt very seriously if a Dallas News reporter would vote for half of the people that were endorsed by the Dallas News editorial policy. There's a very great difference, but the Dallas News is pretty free about, there's just a difference between the front page and editorial page.
In the last decade, has reporting become more aggressive then?
Yeah, I think it has.
Has that been in part, has the Observer played any role in that, the fact that they were?
No, I haven't seen that. I think it's had to do more again with the individuals who were hired and what they wanted to do. But the ones I named, I probably left out a bunch, but you had some pretty strong young people come forward. You know, I wonder how Richard Moorhead and Sam Kintz Jr. sit in the same office sometimes when I know their basic philosophy. But Moorhead covers Briscoe and Kintz covers me. You know, that kind of thing. But they've had an effect.
What's the status?
Most of it in the campaign reporting field and to some degree the Sharpstown thing.
Well, he really broke that, didn't he?
Yeah. Sure did.
The what is the
role? George Kemple would be another one I'd name.
What is the role and effect of organized labor in Texas politics?
Well, they're a part of a building block system. They're solid. I don't know whether they have grown apace with the general population curve, but there's no question that, along about the 60 to 64 era, that it was much more of a plus to have them than not to have them. If you had them in the 50s, you were in trouble. Now, not only are other people tolerant of you having them, but their strength is not, you know, they've never contributed heavily to me at all. But their work made it possible, among other things, for me to win. I'm talking about the placards they nailed up, the endorsements, the hand cards, and that sort of thing. They're not as much a monetary force, but as they are a tremendous help. I mean, you know, you get them and you've got an organization in every county of some kind, virtually. And then they spin off into some areas, like help with some, you know, Chicano elements that they will work with, and they've been, you know, wise under Hank Brown. They got away from just grading people on labor issues and got into a combination of labor and people-oriented issues. You know, they'll be for women's rights, for example. Doesn't have anything to do really with labor. They'll talk about a utilities commission, you know, consumer issues, that kind of thing. So they're a factor.
How about the Chicano? What force do they have now? And is the divisiveness as strong as it was a year or two ago?
Yeah, they've had a hard time getting it together. They are more numerous than the blacks, but they have never been as cohesive. And, you know, the blacks may change leadership. You may go from the preacher-oriented type thing to the NAACP thing and back, but still, the message gets out as to who the right candidate is, and they vote it right. And the Chicano leadership has been a problem. You know, they went initially through an experiment of moving out of the Patron Jefe kind of thing to a Chicano leadership situation, but they then became almost as oppressive as the Patrons and the Jefes were, you know, and it's been very difficult. Then you have La Raza, which is still strong in places like Crystal City, you know, and can win, but which, you know, has also done some things like defeat some good Chicano candidates because of the divisiveness. Joe Bernal.
Have they peaked as a result of that?
I don't know.
Statewide?
I just don't know. Depends on whether a real leader comes or, you know, it's dependent on leadership and how it works. But you probably should have more than two Spanish surnamed members of the Senate, for example. It is not proportional in terms of numbers, the representation of either the Senate or the House.
What do they represent in terms of numbers statewide? About 15%
population? 18, I think.
18.
I haven't looked in a while. I knew that all of that information just like that when we were doing redistricting. But remember.
You said you were on a redistricting board. Was that when you were in the legislature?
No.
Or now?
The Constitution provides that in the event the legislature fails to redistrict, then the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, controller, and land commissioner will sit as a board to redistrict the state.
Was that unique for Texas? I mean, is that a unique feature?
Oh, two or three other states do it, but I can't think who they are. In some states, the Secretary of State does it unilaterally. In some states, a four-man board or five. I was trying to think of some of the other land commissioners that did it. I think they may do it in New Mexico. I am president of all the land commissioners, though. They don't have parallel offices to mine, but every western state has a land commissioner. Well, the federal government gives a certain percentage of the federal lands to the state for land grant colleges and that sort of thing. And so Alaska, Hawaii, then straight down the west coast and over to the tier of states, South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and us, and then everything west, all have land commissioners. Four of us are elected, the rest are appointed. But I work with that organization, though not as much as I should. I mean, I need to devote some time to it when I can find some time this next month or two. We meet again in Tucson in February. But I think some of them perform that redistricting function.
If you look back at the last 20 years in Texas politics, do you see any sort of dividing points and or major either events or personalities that shaped the direction and flow?
Well, obviously, Sharpstown. But again,